Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
This is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan, read the paper. It is Sunday, April 9th, 2017.
That's right.
And so what's going on this week, Dan?
So we saw a play this week. We saw a play.
If I Forget.
I forgot already.
By Stephen Levinson.
Stephen Levinson. A play about which we knew nothing. And I am happy to report it was really good.
Yes.
Yeah. It was...
It was a part of a Roundabout subscription that we have. And we saw it in a small theater, the Laura Pels Theater on 46th Street.
And it's a play that is... the main characters are a Jewish family in early 2000s. They're dealing with issues having to do with politics, in particular Israel.
Why would you really say that? I mean, it's really about the family.
Well, I was going to say,
yeah,
the two levels of issues, and the second level of issues is really about the family. So you have sort of two levels of interactions. You have a political discourse and debate on the one hand, and you also have this family, three siblings in particular, working out some real life difficult conundrums at the same time.
Which boils down to the mother has passed away, the father is older and living in his home, and needs some care.
That's right. And what works, what makes it work, is the characters are so clearly drawn and they're so compelling. They're written well, they're acted well, and that always trumps everything else. Whether you're initially put off by the subject matter, I will say that in the advertising material they had set on the lobby on the way in, they had all these statistics about that spoke to the Jewish experience in the United States. And I was kind of put off by that. I said to myself, I'm not really looking for that. That sounds more like a lecture than a play. But the play was really good.
Right. It was a great depiction of siblings dealing with each other. I mean, it was funny. It was sad. It was angry. It was really painted a picture of family dynamics. Right. Not too dissimilar, similar in some ways to the play The Humans.
That's right.
By Stephen Karam that we saw
with a different ethnicity and a different set of issues, but also compelling in the same way. And you know, I don't mean to say that any part of it was not interesting or convincing, but there was a real political discussion. But in a sense, here's the way I would put it. To me, it was as much about how different generations deal with, in some ways, the shared experience or the experience that is described from one generation to the next. And it's tricky. And the two big events that are dealt with in this play are, of course, the huge event, the Holocaust, on the one hand, and the family's legacy in the sense of some store, some real estate that they own in the Washington, D.C. area, which has now become valuable. And those become the subject of much discussion. In the discussion of the Holocaust, there's a lot of intellectual debate as about what that should mean with respect to one's religiosity, with respect to the attitude and the development of Israel on the one hand. And at a certain point, the discussion comes to a halt because the father, who happened to be in the army and in the unit that helped liberate the Dachau concentration camp, just says, look, you know, for you, this is the quote, he says, history is an abstraction. I was there. I experienced this. He doesn't tell them how to experience it, which, of course, is the question in the play. But he is going to relate to that subject in a particular, tactile, specific, overwhelming way. And it's left to the later generations to sort through what they take from that.
Yeah.
And the same thing's true with the store that they own. Of course, it's much easier to talk about the store and what should they take and what they do quite clearly with respect to the store, possibly also with respect to the Holocaust, but certainly with respect to the store, is they overlay all their own issues on their feelings of the store in the guise of, this is what dad would have wanted, this is what mom would have wanted.
Which is what makes it so real.
Right. And, so, and that leads to the family's problem. So we don't want to tell you more.
Well, I do.
Oh, go ahead.
One unreal aspect of it is the father at the beginning of the play is 75 years old.
He
is portrayed as if he's 95.
Right.
And so
You know what that told us? What did that tell us?
That told us that the playwright is rather young. He is rather young.
Exactly. Exactly.
Actually, he wrote the book for Dear Evan Hansen.
That's right. That's right.
And
but that's like when you talk to your kid. I remember having this conversation with our oldest son, Granger, when he was young. I said, "How old is your teacher?" He says, "I don't know. She's old." I said, "How old?" He said, "This one, he was like 8. He said, "I don't know. I think she's like 16. I said, "She's got to be older than 16. He said, "I don't know, 25. I said, "Maybe." He said, "I don't know, 80? I said, yeah. Right. So, you know, yeah. It's a hard perspective to have. But here's the only caveat. It's not a real caveat about the play. I believe it's only open till the end of April. So while we would urge you to see it, if you get the opportunity, your opportunity is going to be limited. I don't even know how many tickets there are. So we wanted to mention one other play that's going to be
open. But before we leave him, I just wanted to say that...
Yes, sure.
So Stephen Levinson,
right,
up and coming. He's got a commission. He's working on another commission for Roundabout.
Yeah.
He's also working on the book for a musical that is called Everything is Coming Up Prophets.
Well, that's
the Golden Age of Industrial Musicals.
That's
got to be a working title.
Well, I could talk about industrial musicals, but maybe this is not the moment. Yeah, but there is such a thing.
I got it, but another time.
All right, well, talk about someone who's not up and coming, but a play you might want to see. There's a play by Noel Coward, who passed away a few years ago and was a bigger figure in what we'll call the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And the play is Present Laughter. And we want to recommend it. I can't recommend it based on having seen it. It's just open. But again, given timing, it's something that you might not have noted, but it's worth paying attention to. Because as the review in the Times fairly notes, Kevin Kline's great. Kevin Kline's in this play. These kind of plays are often about physical comedy. And Kevin Kline, I think it's been somewhat forgotten, it shouldn't be overlooked, is a great physical comedian. Some of you may be familiar from Fish Called Wanda. For us, it's...
Or more recently.
Or maybe more recently what?
Beauty and the Beast.
Kevin Kline?
Yes, he plays the father of Belle.
Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah.
All right. Well, there you go. But when we know Kevin Kline when he was a up-and-comer, we saw him in On the 20th Century. God, how many years ago was that?
A million.
30 years ago, 40 years ago, and he played the juvenile lead. And he was quite acrobatic and hysterically funny. He was in a few years later in The Pirates of Penzance, in which he was a little bit goofy, swooping around, singing, and again, very convincing.
Did we see that in Central Park?
We did, with Linda Ronstadt.
Oh,
there you go.
Okay.
But no, Linda Ronson wasn't sitting with us. He was in the play. But, and the fact is, Kevin Kline, I can easily see Kevin Kline being great. That Time says Kevin Kline's great. I'm convinced he must be great. So keep your eye out for Present Laughter. It's just open.
And maybe you'll take me to see that?
I think it's on the list.
Okay.
All right.
There you have it. Time for museum update.
Okay, museum update. Bell went off. Museum update.
Ding, 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 ding. Museum update. You know, I can't even believe this. Yeah. I can't even believe it. Last week, Monday morning, front page of the Times, below the fold, but front page of the Times, Metropolitan Museum was there. Okay?
Yeah.
So I'm not going to talk about the Met anymore.
Right.
I'm just not going to talk about the Met. I'm no good at this. I don't get it at all.
You're losing me.
Because, you know, remember we're down in Richmond, we're having this conversation, the Met is in trouble financially, and we're coming up with all these ideas of what it really takes to run a big organization
like
really
the
Met. And it's really not... the story is, it turns out, one of the Met's big, you know, problems really relates to the director having an affair with somebody in IT.
Well, IT is the place to look.
You know, and that people have, they've had, you know, trouble maintaining staff.
Do you think that's the reason for their...
Not for their financial difficulties.
Right.
I think that may be why he's having difficulty running the organization, or it may be indicative you know, I mean, you think that these are major, organized, professional... I mean, it just seems like... You know, old time, the rich people do what the rich people want to do.
Well, look, it's old people at the end of the day.
But it's sad. I mean, I was at the Met a week ago on that rainy Friday.
Yeah.
And it was jammed. It was jammed.
Right.
And you're looking around and saying, if they can't make money with right. this crowd,
exactly.
they can't make
they
money.
They should be printing you know, money.
It was insane.
Well, you told me. You said there's practically no place to stand.
No, people were sitting on the floor of the Great Hall.
Yeah.
I mean, they were just, and they were everywhere.
Yeah.
By the way, there's a couple of good shows at the Met now, including The Age of Empire, about the Han Dynasty, Terracotta Warriors. Dug up out of tombs from 2,000 years old. And I don't know anything about them. Again, it's one of those things where it's just great, fascinating.
This is stuff your students like?
No, my students didn't get to see it because it was only open to members.
Oh, really?
At the time. And I had had to re-up my membership. Mm-hmm. I believe in being a member.
Right.
It's economical, and I believe in supporting these institutions. So I re-upped for membership. And I got into that show early. They have a preview for members. And I also got into the Balcony Lounge,
yeah.
which is normally for very high-up members. You know, you have to shell out the big bucks.
Right.
And they have couches and a bar.
Well, you got to see how the other
I did not have to sit on the floor of the Great Hall because I was in the Balcony Lounge.
Okay. What's the other show besides the Terracotta, whatever you were going to mention?
No, I was going to say not at the Met, but another fun thing to see at the moment is over at the Cooper Hewitt.
Oh, okay.
And that is, you know, the Cooper Hewitt Museum, it's not far from the Met. It originally was Andrew Carnegie's mansion. You know Andrew Carnegie.
Yeah, no, I even knew that.
Industrial magnate.
Right, yeah.
It's a fantastic mansion. It's the basically the Smithsonian Museum of Design, more or less. And the current exhibition is about the Jazz Age, American style in the 1920s.
Right.
Normally we call that Art Deco. For some reason, they don't want to call it Art Deco.
Oh, really?
No.
I think the Times called it Art Deco.
The Times did. And the Times also, you know, and discusses that. You know, what's the issue? Does this make any sense? So it's great, fun, you know, mostly decorative arts, as it were, furniture, in addition to paintings, posters, textiles, etc. Mm-hmm. But also on the second floor, there's a wonderful little exhibition called The Jeweled Splendors of Art Deco, of the Art Deco era.
Mm-hmm.
And it's jewelry, Art Deco jewelry, which sounds cool, but the coolest part of it is the room it is in.
Mm-hmm.
It's in a room called the Teak Room. And that was originally, I think, a library. And it was actually designed and installed by Lockwood DeForest,
mm-hmm.
who was a partner with Louis Comfort Tiffany in their design firm.
Mm-hmm.
And DeForest was a great fan of the carvings of India. He actually set up a wood carving shop in India to provide all these very exotic furniture and paneling for American for the American wealthy at the turn of the century. So it's a great room to see, and it's a great little exhibition, great chance to see that.
Okay.
So go to the Cooper Hewitt.
All right. So not article in the Times this week was about a golf tournament, women's golf tournament, a major though, significant tournament, which was decided in an odd way. The woman who was leading the tournament, named Lexi Thompson, had a two-stroke lead, and she was cruising to what seemed like an easy victory when she was informed by an official that she was going to be assessed a four-stroke penalty, and it was because of something that had happened a number of holes earlier that had passed without incident. A television viewer had called in and seen the replay and said that, alerted the official that should look at the replay because Lexi Thompson had moved her ball a few inches.
How do you even do that?
How
do you know what number to call?
I don't know. I'm just reading
the
paper.
Does that seem right?
The whole thing's crazy.
Should we now start doing that? Can we do that during Giants games?
The Masters is still going on.
Can we do that during the Mets game? The Masters is, you know.
That's
sort of crazy, isn't it?
That
blows my mind.
Let me explain what happened first. People have to understand what happened. So what happens is that they say, we got this tip, we looked at the instant replay, and in fact, you did move your ball. You're being assessed two strokes for moving the ball and two additional strokes for not reporting that you moved the ball. And
Larry from Queens was right.
Larry from Queens was called in, And she lost the tournament as a result. This is a big time
tournament. Poor, poor girl. And a few, I can't even imagine.
All right. So, and he, look, Tiger Woods had the same reaction you did. He actually had on his Twitter feed, viewers at home should not be officials wearing stripes. I don't know if that was a fashion comment or he's just agreeing with you that you can't be officiating.
This should not be.
Okay. So it's crazy in many ways. But it's also, you know, the whole idea of instant replay has gotten totally out of hand. And you see it, it's permeating officiating. You see everything is now subject to instant replay, sometimes at home, sometimes actually at the event. And that's not what instant replay was about. I should mention, first of all, instant replay has not always been with us. It was created in the 1960s. There's been a lot of sports and a lot of televised sports without instant replay. But it was not developed for officiating. It came about to enhance the experience. It was first put on television in 1963 in a very famous Army-Navy game in which Roger Staubach was quarterbacking for Navy and Raleigh Stitchway was quarterbacking for Army. In a close game, Raleigh Stitchway and Army scored a touchdown. And then they showed an instant replay, and Lindsey Nelson, the announcer, had to say on the air, as a note to viewers, Mr. Stitchway has not scored a second touchdown. We actually are showing a replay of the first touchdown. Don't be misled. That's how new it was. Yeah. But the truth is that the technology wasn't really right in 63. So it wasn't until a few years in 1967 that they really sought to use it in a little more earnest. And here's how it caught on. It's kind of odd. It's a confluence of events. The same time replay got a little better, you had perhaps the most famous football game in the history of the National Football League. And that, of course, was the Ice Bowl. And with Dallas Cowboys played the Green Bay Packers in the championship game in 1967. And very famous game, iconic. You had Tom Landry and you had Vince Lombardi. And you had Dallas Cowboys in the lead by 3 points with about a minute or so going to go. And you had Green Bay driving for a possible touchdown. They're at the 13-yard line. They hand the ball to Chuck Mercine, who went to Yale of all places, runs to the 3-yard line. First down the 3. Time is running down. First play on the frozen field, Donnie Anderson takes the handoff. The halfback for Green Bay slips, barely gets back to the line. Second play, the same thing. And now they call their final timeout with a few seconds to go. And the question is, what are they going to do? Are they going to run it? Do they have the footing? Are they going to pass, which would save a possible field goal? They snap the ball. They hand the ball to Bart Starr. He gets in for a touchdown. Green Bay wins. And then you have the Green Bay legend. That's fine. But then what's interesting is this. They showed the instant replay. And when they showed the instant replay, the announcers who had been getting so excited about Bart Starr making this heroic play, they said, wait a minute. You know what's interesting about that play? Jethro Pugh, the great defensive tackle for the Cowboys, was basically blocked out by the guard, the offensive lineman for Green Bay, called Jerry Kramer. That's what made the play. That's what made the play. He's the star. And they kept showing this play. And suddenly, Jerry Kramer became famous because they were naturally able to explain what's really going on here is the guard play. It has nothing to do with the quarterback. Well, what happened in a nutshell is Green Bay became the legend that it is. Jerry Kramer became famous. And there was a whole wealth of articles and, of course, books written about the Green Bay Packers. And strangely, the most famous book of all of them was the one written by Jerry Kramer. And the name of the book, Instant Replay.
And I get the feeling you are remembering all of this.
Yes.
Yes. It's only your own instant replay.
I watched that game, yes. It's worked for me for a long time.
Hey, so I came across an article in the Times Review section about job interviews. It's titled Against Job Interviews, written by a professor from management and marketing at the Yale School of Management. And basically, his point is that face-to-face interviews can actually be misleading, if not harmful, to the sort of job or school admissions process. In fact, they compared people, there's a variety of studies. One of the interesting ones has to do with a school that suddenly had 50 more slots available to admit more students. Mm-hmm. And so they went down to the next level and admitted 50 more students who had lost out before because they had the credentials that were as good as the students admitted, but their interviews were not as good. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that those students, once they were admitted, mm-hmm. did just as well.
Yeah.
Their performance was no different. And so that interview, the good or bad interview, was not at all indicative of their success in school.
I think interviews are highly questionable, and even more than that, not only questionable value, but possibly counterproductive, because I think they're overemphasized. And I'm talking about it from a hiring perspective. And what I find in interviews is there's a lot of confirmation bias. There's a lot of feeling that if someone says something in an interview that resonates with the interviewer's experience or resonates with their expectations, that the interviewer comes away with a great deal of confidence and positivity about the applicant that's really unwarranted.
Right. Just because you've had a good chat
doesn't
mean that you can really perform this job.
Right. And there's some similar thinking to that in the Kahneman book, the Daniel Kahneman book, Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow, that it's not unusual to have a strong, immediate, visceral reaction to something that's just misplaced. Because it's just muscle memory, but it's not really based on the kind of objective factors, or it says factors, subjective or objective, that are the most reliable. So I think interviews often can be counterproductive and cause you not to look at what really matters. But having said that, that doesn't mean that the opposite is true. It doesn't mean you just go on numbers or grades.
Yeah.
It just means you have to find a better way, whether that's better interviewing or looking for other factors that pull out of the person's experience that broaden your picture of the person. But sitting down with someone is a very dangerous way to hire people.
Yeah, and you are seeing more attempts to actually test people in ways or give concrete, consistent questioning rather than just random chit-chat.
That's interesting.
Yeah, interesting point. Jason Dana.
Okay.
In the New York Times.
All right. Not to overwhelm everyone with Broadway, just a couple of other quick points, because it's just kind of odd. You know, we recommended Present Laughter. We did not recommend Amelie, which is not to say it's really bad or anything like that. We haven't seen it. But the reviews weren't very good, except for one. And here's what's funny. When you open the Times Arts and Leisure today, on page 5, there's a full-page ad for Amelie, which is effectively a reprint of a review by Charles Isherwood, who is known as the reviewer at the New York Times, and it is very positive. There's only one problem with this. Charles Isherwood was dismissed from the New York Times because there was some dispute or feud involving him and Ben Brantley. So this is not a New York Times review. It's by Charles Isherwood, now working for the Broadway News. But the way it's presented, and given the way that viewers, readers of the Times think of Charles Isherwood, you think you're reading a New York Times review.
Right. I mean, it does say Broadway News on it.
Right, it does.
But it's a full-page ad reprinting this interview.
And I had to think to myself, and say, I thought I read the Times review, and I thought it was negative. Uh-huh. And, of course, it was. So that was a little off. The other point that came out of the Times, Broadway-oriented, was a little different story, but it's something that we've been mildly familiar with, because anyone who reads Playbill magazine or listens to Seth Rudetsky on Sirius, I guess the Broadway station, would know about this. And that is, they have these cruises.
Cruises. We're back to cruises.
Yeah, maybe you can
we're
explain the cruises.
We're going to retire in the world of cruises,
right,
aren't we?
Yes. Yeah. But
it's Broadway-themed cruises, I guess, put together by Playbill, the Playbill company. And it will have a variety of Broadway stars performing over the course of the cruise. And I think generally cruises, they go various places.
This one to the Caribbean, I'm talking about here.
And so the stars are there with you on the cruise.
And they're big stars. They advertise at least big stars. 4 or 5 big stars might be on the cruise, and you have a lot of Broadway fans on the cruise.
And Seth is often on the cruise.
And Seth is there. Seth is something between a star and a fan. I think that's fair.
Kind of the MC.
Exactly. Yeah. And so people enjoy the Caribbean, enjoy seeing Broadway performances, and also hanging out with the Broadway
stars. So
there's
an article in the Times Arts and Leisure written by Melissa Errico.
Right, who we've seen on Broadway. She's excellent.
We saw her recently.
Yeah, we did. But she's very good. She's very good. And but she's describing her experience on the cruise. And what's kind of interesting is she says she gives a good perspective on it, and she says she enjoys doing it. Some of it's awkward and some of it's not awkward. But this
you're dealing with the fans on a pretty intimate basis. I mean, you're there with them.
Right. At the end of the day, when she boils it down, she says this. She says, in the evenings, actors often sat at the actor's table in the rear of the restaurant. We talked about time and enduring, music and phrasing, and failing and getting up. Few of us knew what work would come our way when we got home. In part, this is what makes the cruise, despite its brushes with glamour, authentic. The fans get an up-close sense of the vulnerability of their performers.
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting. I don't think we're ready for a cruise. But
so she was there with her whole family, right?
That's right. She was there with her, which includes, we happen to know, Patrick McEnroe. She's married to Patrick McEnroe, John McEnroe's younger brother.
Right.
And a distinguished tennis player in his own right.
6 degrees of separation. Didn't the McEnroes play at your dad's tennis courts?
Not the McEnroes, but friends of the McEnroes.
Oh, friends of the McEnroes. But they were that's pretty close.
But they played in at Harry Hopman's tennis academy, where my younger brother Michael played. So there's plenty of degrees. We're connected. We're totally connected
with the,
exactly,
the Ericos.
All right. So another article in the Times that struck us, and this is has to do with cricket. We wanted to cover cricket.
We like to cover cricket.
Yes,
every few weeks we talk about cricket.
And this is going to be a new phrase that you're going to hear for the first time, but you'll be repeating to your friends and relatives for a long time. Instead of the phrase "life imitating art," it will be "life imitating games." That's what we're going to carry into the.
It doesn't have much of a ring, does it?
It keeps saying
but
it.
But you think I've got to repeat it to
and
my
here's,
friends?
Well, let me tell you this story. And I'll tell you pretty quickly. Basically, there's a cricket. A league, a very prestigious cricket league, the Indian Premier League, which sponsors a particular subdivision, if you will. And the way they staff the teams is through a draft. Well, that's not unusual. And basically, the players are all drafted anew each year. The teams almost start with a blank roster.
All the players.
Yeah, except for five. They get to keep five players. The rest are all subject to this draft. But here's what's interesting about the draft. The draft is conducted by a fellow, Richard Madley, who used to run Christie's East in New York. So it's run as a real auction house thing. Each team is given a certain allotment because of the salary cap, call it, I don't know, $10 million, let's say. And they bid for players with that allotment in mind. So
each team has $10 million to spend.
Right.
And this is an auction.
Now, it's an auction. Now, let me stop for a moment. This, for those of you in rotisserie leagues or baseball fantasy leagues, this is the way those leagues are often run.
Right.
It's exactly that. You sit around and you allot certain, you know, faux dollars to various players, and that's how you end up with your team. The difference here is that these are real people. So when you have a picture of the fellow doing the auction, they're auctioning off real people. And at the end, the owner wins that person for a certain salary. It'll be a healthy salary.
The people have nothing to say about it.
That's it. They're done. They're bought.
They don't want to move to...
Right. Some strange country, some strange part of the world, they're there. Yeah. And they're subject to the auction. It is exactly like a baseball or football fantasy draft, writ large, in real life, life-imitating games.
Cricket is crazy. There's little question about that.
You say cricket is crazy, and yet I wonder, before you see that in other sports. So that's jarring. It's the future.
Okay, so reading the Wall Street Journal magazine section this week about design, and I'm just reading the little, you know, kind of interview info about a floral designer, Ruby Barber, mm-hmm. From Berlin, mm-hmm. and they ask her what her, you know, favorite restaurant is,
right.
And it's a restaurant, she says, I love the ricotta pancakes at Granger and Company in London.
Really?
So, of course, I got to Google this. I got to look this up immediately. Turns out this is a restaurant owned by Bill Granger.
Really?
Who apparently is a big food star.
Right.
He's from Australia.
Right.
He's famous for his restaurants in Australia. Yeah. He has restaurants in Japan. He has restaurants in the UK.
All right.
And he's got what's described as an eclectic and simple cuisine. Had a vegetarian mother, butcher father, and he's famous for his scrambled eggs, fluffy scrambled eggs,
right.
And he's famous for YouTube videos of how to cook. I mean, he's incredibly famous, Bill Granger. Never heard of him, but now I have.
Okay,
so because my last name is Granger, it makes me kind of
I got it.
Interested. I don't think we're related.
Am I going to go on to the next story, or did you have something else on floral design?
No. That was all about Bill Granger.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you had me confused. All right. Well, the next story, we're coming toward the close here, is about the New York Times, which apparently is responding to one of our previous casts. Those of you who are loyal listeners, remember... Yes. We spoke at some length.
You have mean things to say about the Times.
The Times doesn't cover sports. They're all over the place. They're not interested in sports. And we made that point by dwelling on an article that took four pages of the New York Times about bighorn sheep. Well, the Times has something in the nature of an ombudsman who supposedly looks at the Times and looks at complaints about the Times and gives an independent view of what they do right and do wrong. And it's an entirely unsatisfactory article, generally speaking, I will tell you. But in any event, quite apart from that, they have an article about their sports coverage, which is also entirely unsatisfactory, in which they acknowledge that they get a lot of complaints about the Times sports coverage. But they say, you know, there are limitations. The Times has just so many reporters, and it's a big world out there, and we know people are interested in the Knicks, but but why? And let me tell you, I can't even dwell on it because it was driving me crazy, but it captures the situation in this paragraph or two. This is, again, the Times ombudsman. And there was the 4,000-word story on bighorn sheep hunting in Montana, where permits go for $100,000. The piece, beautifully executed by writer John Branch, explores the paradox of using money from hunting fees to revive the dwindling herds. The feature resonated with many readers and infuriated others who questioned why it was a sports story to begin with. It's hard to criticize a piece with the artistry and sophistication of this one, but it's also hard to imagine how a staff of 20 writers with a mandate to cover the world can afford to pick such obscure targets. Okay, so this is the point at a cocktail party or a dinner party where you're having a conversation with someone, they say something like this, and you turn to the person on the other side, you say, the person on my right just can't understand anything, okay? They don't get it. This person is not interested in sports.
So the Times just doesn't get it?
They don't. It's not even close. There's no response I can offer. I mean, if that's their explanation, say, well, we covered the sheep. I know it's not sports, but it's such a good article. Okay, fine. All right, good for you. So Times is not going to get it. All right.
Not making any improvements.
So I wanted to close by coming back.
No, you're not allowed to close yet.
What do you
got? I want to talk about a book.
Oh, go ahead.
Because there's, in the review section of the Wall Street Journal, there's a review of The Evolution of the Costumed Avenger.
By
Jess Nevins.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about
and
that.
And so many people near and dear to us are fans of costume adventures. And it traces the history of the superhero with a shout out to your friend and mine, Gilgamesh, citing his buddy Enkidu as the first proto superhero because he comes along and he, you know, writes some wrongs, writes some of the Gilgamesh wrongs. He's also kind of a wild man, a little bit furry, so I guess he has a link to, you know.
I don't know.
Yeah,
Wolverine. Yeah.
Wolverine. Okay, so it's just...
You missed Tamsin acting out Wolverine. It was interesting.
So there you have that. So, it looks interesting. I'm not going to go into...
I will say this, our children growing up had the benefit of a father who knew about Marvel Comics, whatever benefit that is, and a mother who was able to explain to them that that's nothing compared to Gilgamesh and his buddy.
3,000 years
ago. So they were the only children who went to school
with all of that,
an education in both and a preference for Gilgamesh.
Actually, once I did drag Zeke to a... There was an exhibition at the Met of superhero costumes, and there was a whole set of talks about superhero art, etc. And when I found out the important information that men don't wear spandex to fight crime.
No, I knew that.
Men fight crime so they can wear spandex.
That's why I wear spandex. I fight crime. can't even figure that one out. I'm not responding.
I'm staying away from spandex. Now you can wind up by going back to
the point about the play, really, about the way generations experience things differently and how the later generation work through what the earlier generation did. And it strangely manifests itself in the NCAA tournament. One in a fairly superficial way, and that's the first one. It's just kind of interesting that Gonzaga, people throughout the tournament kept saying, well, we don't know much about Gonzaga. What can we learn about Gonzaga? And they really didn't get much information about Gonzaga. And I was talking to my dad, who's 95, and I said, Gonzaga? He said, Gonzaga, that's Bing Crosby's school. I said, oh, who knew that? The Bingster. Bing, it turns out, by the way, I did check, was the number one recording artist of the 20th century. Sold more recordings than anybody. Did you know that?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
More than like Michael Jackson? Or
Michael Jackson, Frank Sinatra, Elvis Presley, Lennon McCartney. Okay. It's all Bing. Right. It's a Bing world. Der Bingle, Bing Crosby. And Bing Crosby, Gonzaga housed a large collection of material dedicated to and donated from Bing Crosby. There's a library that was devoted to him. There is a Crosbyana room in the Crosby Civic Center. There is a statue with Bing and his pipe. So he's still a figure. He wasn't mentioned during the tournament, but in a more serious way.
Boo, 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 boo.
There you go. That's uncanny. That's like being me and Bing. Frank Martin, who we mentioned before, is the coach of South Carolina. On a more serious note, in terms of the way generations deal with each other and what they expect from younger generations. It's a funny thing. When you watch the basketball tournament, you can't help but notice that these kids are really working incredibly hard. They're dedicated. They're diving all over the place. This is their moment. They're killing themselves. And at the same time, you have some older coach of a different generation is basically barking at them, barking them loudly the whole time, exhorting them, encouraging them, demanding from them. It's not surprisingly that people ask the question eventually, like, how does that really work? How does that go over? I mean, so-called millennials, new generation, have a different attitude. Perhaps they have different kind of motivational buttons or harder motivational buttons to find. Do they respond to that kind of thing? I mean, aren't millennials just different? And this article kind of captures it with a quote from Frank Martin, where it says that Martin took umbrage at the notion that young people have changed, making it harder for strict disciplinarians like him to survive in the coaching profession. And this is Martin's quote. He says, "The kids haven't changed. We've changed as adults. We demand less of kids. We expect less of kids. We make their lives easier instead of preparing them for what life is truly about. We're the ones that have changed." So that's interesting. And I think that winds up our session today. You can expect to hear us next week
with Tamsin and Dan read the paper.
Thank you.